Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello and welcome to the Black Experience Hour. This is a weekly program. This is being recorded for the listening week that begins April 20th. Your reader's name is Susan Shirey. This week's sources, among others, include The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, TheRoot.com, and Denver Urban Spectrum. And the articles you will be hearing include a memoriam for Reverend Cecil Murray, who passed on April 5th, a couple of articles on O.J. Simpson, some theater news from Denver, and others. Beginning with the article from The New York Times, published April 9th, written by Clay Risen. Reverend Cecil Murray, leader amid Los Angeles riots, dies at 94. He used his church, First African Methodist Episcopal, as a base to address the social ills that confronted the city's black population. The Reverend Cecil Murray, a minister who turned a struggling church in Los Angeles into one of the country's largest congregations, then made it a base to combat the many ills facing the city's black population, most notably during and after the 1992 riots, died on Friday at his home in the View Park Windsor Hills section of Los Angeles. He was 94. The death was announced by the Center for Religion and Civic Culture at the University of Southern California, where he had taught after retiring from the church. When Mr. Murray arrived at First African Methodist Episcopal Church in 1977, it was both storied and troubled. It was the oldest black church west of the Mississippi, but it was loaded with debt and attracted just a few hundred congregants. Mr. Murray, known as Chip, brought new life to the church. He replaced the traditional choir with the gospel ensemble. His rich baritone voice and entrancing speaking style drew new worshipers. Within a decade, he had retired the church's debt and brought attendance up to about 7,000. The church was among the most prominent in the city's black community, and Mr. Murray was among its most respected religious leaders. Tom Bradley, the city's first black mayor, was a member. Presidents, governors, and world leaders visited the church, and Mr. Murray led the funeral services for black celebrities like Mr. Bradley, Ray Charles, and Eazy-E. Celebrity status, though, meant little to him. His focus was the struggling communities of South Central Los Angeles. He created outreach programs to combat gang violence and substance abuse. He brought in investors to support low-income housing, scholarships, and home loan programs. He could feel the tension building after four white Los Angeles police officers were charged with beating a black motorist, Rodney King, in 1991. On April 28, 1992, the day before the verdict in the officer's trial was expected, he set up loudspeakers in the parking lot of his church so that neighbors could follow the events. The next day, the jury found all four men not guilty of assault. (One was convicted of using excessive force. A few hours later, an usher came to find Mr. Murray in the church. He brought him outside and pointed south. Flames were rising. Then he pointed at flames to the east, then to the west. By the first night, fires had come within a half block of the church. The fire department refused to deploy in the area unless firefighters' safety from rock-throwing rioters could be guaranteed. Mr. Murray assembled some 100 men to stand as a cordon around the fire trucks. He also opened up the church to the Red Cross and its basement to more than 100 people left homeless by the fires. In the weeks and months that followed, he went on a whirlwind campaign to raise money for rebuilding. He went on Nightline and the Arsenio Hall show. Mr. Hall was a congregant and met with corporate executives, ultimately raising more than $1.5 million. But he was quick to note that this was only the beginning. More than 50 people died in the unrest, which caused some $1 billion in damage, and he feared that there would be more violence to come soon. Quote, "You feel the thermometer rising," he told the New York Times in September 1992. He went on, "It's like a fever. This place is like a dog that's been in a fight. The hairs on his back are still standing up." End quote. Cecil Leonard Murray was born on September 26, 1929, in Lakeland, Florida, to Janie Williams and Robert Murray. His mother died when he was about three, and his father later moved with Cecil and his siblings, Louise and Edward, to West Palm Beach, Florida, where he was hired as a high school principal. Cecil took to the pulpit early. He was a junior preacher from middle school through his senior year in high school. It was the era of the Jim Crow South. Cecil and his brother once watched his father confront a group of white men as they harassed several black people standing in line at a soup kitchen. The men responded by assaulting Robert Murray, then Cecil, and Edward, too. The incident seemed to break something in his father, who grew addicted to alcohol. Mr. Murray said his father's experience helped guide his own vision for his ministry. Quote, "It's funny," he told the Los Angeles Times, "but you don't remember the weaknesses. You remember the greatness of spirit and the sensitivity that allowed him to absorb the pain. Eventually, it destroyed him." End quote. Mr. Murray graduated with a degree in history from Florida A&M University, an historically black institution. He graduated in 1951 and then entered the Air Force, where he served as a radar intercept officer. In 1958, while he was at Oxnard Air Force Base, northwest of Los Angeles, his two-seat plane crashed on takeoff. He was pinned in the back but managed to escape, though the pilot suffered fatal third-degree burns. Before the pilot died, he asked Mr. Murray to visit him in the hospital. While there, Mr. Murray told the Los Angeles Times in 2004, quote, "He told me he had not forgotten me and he was trying to help me. So those two traumas, the depth of his love and the delivery of my life, made me know that I had to live beyond me," end quote. He married Bernadine Cousin in 1958. She died in 2013. He is survived by their son, Drew. Mr. Murray left the Air Force in 1961, set on the ministry. He received a doctorate from the Claremont School of Theology in 1964, after which he assumed the pulpit of a tiny church in Pomona, California. He later preached in Kansas City, Kansas, and Seattle before joining First African Methodist Episcopal. In the wake of the riots, Mr. Murray redoubled his outreach efforts. In 2001, he opened the FAME Renaissance Center, which became a base for the church's social services. It soon oversaw a portfolio of some $400 million in community projects. Mr. Murray retired from the pulpit in 2004, after which he became a professor at the University of Southern California. He spent his time training ministers and other church officials in social engagement, coming in for a full day of work every morning until the coronavirus pandemic in 2020. He retired in 2022. Quote, "On Sunday, it's about saving souls, but on Monday through Saturday, it's about saving the community," he told the Knight Ridder News Service in 1995. He went on, "I think the church that's about personal salvation but doesn't address the needs of the community is blasphemous." End quote. Turning next to TheRoot.com for those two articles on O.J. Simpson. This first written by Dustin J. Seibert, published April 12th. O.J. Simpson's trial of the century put black people against white people, dash, and we won. But at what cost? O.J.'s 1995 murder trial captivated the world and sparked a very clear racial division. 30 years ago, before viral was a thing, and social media gave us countless things on which to focus, we basically all had one device, a television, to keep us hooked to the single most compelling event in the 1990s, colon, the O.J. Simpson murder trial. There was no black Twitter / X to confirm it at the time, but the temperature was obvious. Black folks largely sided with Simpson, who died of cancer Wednesday evening at 76, during the trial. Back in June 1994, the summer before I entered eighth grade, I came downstairs to see my father glued to the television watching A.C. Cowling's Driving Simpson, (parentheses), who was allegedly holding a gun to his head, in what's now known, in what's now the most famous white Ford Bronco of all time, for what became the most famous slow-speed police chase of all time. I was not yet imbued with the knowledge that black men running from the cops at any speed was no good, but I was captivated just the same. Because he kept the family television glued to the E! Network every evening, Pops basically forced me to pay attention to the nearly year-long trial of the century. It occurred during a racially turbulent time in the country, just a couple of years after the Los Angeles Police Department's beating of Rodney King and the subsequent L.A. riots. When Simpson's defense team revealed that LAPD Detective Mark Furman was dropping N-bombs on tape, black folks knew that he and his team were not to be trusted. The argument that Furman planted gloves to nail Simpson, and the latter's famous failure to fit said gloves, were the cherries on top that we needed to believe Simpson was an innocent man. In my black city of Detroit, defense attorney Johnny Cochran was a borderline deity. His dream team, which included Robert Shapiro, Alan Dershowitz, and Robert Kardashian, (parentheses) years before his ex-wife and their devil spawn took over the zeitgeist, were heroes. Meanwhile, prosecutor Marcia Clark was the enemy, constantly clowned in the tabloid media for her frumpy, sartorial choices and generally, quote, unsexy appearance during a time when the Baywatch babe was still a thing. Christopher Darden was a sellout, the likes of Ben Carson post-2013, a successful black man trying to take down another successful black man. As a high school freshman, I remembered the cheers from students in the other classroom the moment Simpson's not guilty verdict was read, October 7, 1995. I also remember news outlets at the time making a point to show the contrasting reactions of white audiences and black audiences as the verdict was read, cheering versus bleeped out swearing. Of course, time and more than a few mind-numbingly ridiculous moves on the part of the juice have made black folks reconsider our position on his guilt, but his exoneration was a middle finger to the racist legal system and made us feel like winners, even if for a little while. And the next article is written by Nigel Roberts, published on the 17th. What black people say about O.J. Simpson when white people aren't around. The juice's death has social media abuzz about what black folks really believe. In a viral TikTok video, user Xian Divine admitted that he only says O.J. Simpson was guilty of the double murder that made him go from famous to infamous around other black people. He said, quote, "He's the only black man that the justice system has ever let slip through like that," end quote. But around white people, he doesn't defend Simpson. Instead, he listens to their views. It's a, quote, "racism litmus test" to find out who among them is not to be trusted. A woman admitted she vigorously argues to non-black people that Simpson is innocent. But among her black friends, she has a different view. Quote, "O.J. Def did that shit," end quote. Others on social media are surprised and confused that white folk believed that black people thought Simpson was innocent. One social media user posted to X, formerly Twitter, quote, "It's a running joke just how guilty O.J. was." Indeed, black people often admit, among each other, that Simpson was guilty as hell, but we would never confess that to white people. Comedian Thelonious Monk wrote, quote, "To this day, some of them sincerely believe that black people thought O.J. was innocent," end quote. Simpson's white ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend Ronald Goldman were brutally murdered at Nicole's Los Angeles home on June 12, 1994. Prosecutors argued that the evidence pointed to the former NFL hero's guilt, evidence that included DNA on what prosecutors argued was Simpson's bloody glove, size 12 Bruno Magli shoe prints, and socks found in his bedroom. But that evidence wasn't ironclad. A majority black jury saw things differently. They, along with about 71% of black folks, said the fallen NFL star was not guilty of double murder, exposing a glaring racial divide. Why would so many black people say that Simpson didn't do it? There are lots of theories still floating around 30 years later. Well, let's start with the racist cop. At the trial, former LAPD Detective Mark Furman, who allegedly found the bloody glove, denied ever using the N-word, but the defense presented audio evidence of him spewing the slur. He then invoked his Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination when asked if he ever planted evidence. There's also the timing of the, quote, trial of the century. It unfolded a few years after the 1992 L.A. riots. Black voices cried out for justice after a video emerged of LAPD officers brutally beating black motorist Rodney King. But the justice system once again failed the black community. A white jury acquitted the four officers, igniting the riot. Our excitement at Simpson's acquittal wasn't about the man's innocence or guilt. It was all about generations of injustice and white people killing blacks with impunity. Nearly 30 years later, that's much easier for black people to admit, dash, to each other. Next, turn to CPR News for some Denver theater news. And both of these articles reference plays that have just closed, but are interesting nevertheless. This written by Eden Lane, published March 29th. The Aurora Fox launches a 10-year commitment to produce 10 plays by two-time Pulitzer Prize winner August Wilson. The Aurora Fox Theater on Colfax has embarked on an ambitious 10-year commitment to produce all 10 plays by two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright August Wilson. This collection of 10 plays, written between 1982 and 2005, is known as the American Century Cycle and portrays the black experience in Pittsburgh throughout the 20th century. The first installment, Gem of the Ocean, that's G-E-M, opened to critical acclaim last weekend, marking the beginning of a decades-long journey into the heart of black America. Director Donnie L. Betts, all spelled with lowercase letters, expressed a deep admiration for Wilson's storytelling prowess, which won the playwright numerous Tony nominations and the Peabody Award. Betts said, quote, "He's a master storyteller. That was my challenge because when you're going to do all 10 plays, that's a big commitment from a theater." Betts, who recognized Gem of the Ocean as an opportunity to set the tone for the rest of the American Century Cycle at the Aurora Fox. Executive producer Richard Cowden, who took over after the current season was programmed, said Gem of the Ocean, which takes place in 1904, sets the stage for the 20th century cycle. quote. One of our lead characters is 285 years old, which is significant because that is the distance between 1904 and 1619, which of course was when the first enslaved individuals arrived in this country, or what became this country, said Cowden, he went on. This play really dives deeply into Black history and ritual and mythology, end quote. One of the production's unique elements is the inclusion of original music by Laria Edwards. Betts said, quote, I am a big believer in the original music, and I do a lot of things with soundscape in my productions, end quote. Quilts were also commissioned specifically for the show, designed by artists from the Rocky Mountain Washonahi Quilt Guild. They add a tactile and visual dimension to the production. Quote, we are so honored because you know that art isn't, we are so honored because you know that art that isn't practiced sort of dies. And what we like to focus on is teaching people the art of quilting, said Joette Bailey Kyown, president of the Rocky Mountain Washonai Quilt Guild and one of eight quilters for the show. Bailey Kiawan said Betts came to the guild in December, read parts of the play, and described what it was that he needed. She said the guild saw this as an opportunity to expand beyond its usual offerings of trunk shows, standing exhibits, and presentations. Quote, our main theme is each one teaches one, and for this quilt to be featured in the play, it screams that the art still exists. There are people that are still interested in doing this artwork. For this to be an element of this play is really exciting for us. Betts said everyone can find something to relate to in Wilson's plays because they talk about the human spirit. Quote, parentheses, writer and musician, Oscar Brown Jr., he always talked about the revolution of the human heart. It's what we need as people, said Betts. And I think in August's work, you hear and see that revolution of the human heart, end quote. Gem of the Ocean by August Wilson plays at the Aurora Fox through Sunday, April 14th. The second article, also written by Eden Lane, was published April 3rd. Why Town Hall Arts Center is hosting a blackout night for its production of the musical Raisin. Still reading from CPR News. Town Hall Arts Center in Littleton is doing something that hasn't ever been done by a Colorado theater company before. It's designating this Saturday's performance of the musical Raisin as a blackout performance. That means the company is inviting Black people specifically to fill the audience for this musical adaptation of Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun. Quote, this blackout performance is not just about getting people to the theater, explained director Christopher Page Sanders, who went on, it's getting people to the theater and getting them involved or excited about potentially becoming involved, end quote. Blackout shows are the brainchild of playwright Jeremy O. Harris, who first debuted the idea in 2019 during the Broadway run of his work, Slave Play. The Blackout Night website defines a blackout as, quote, the purposeful creation of an environment in which an all-Black identifying audience can experience and discuss an event in the performing arts, film, athletic, and cultural spaces, dash, free from the white gaze, end quote. Harris has said shows like Slave Play and Raisin, which deal with racial trauma, can be a hypersensitive experience for Black audiences. Savannah Reeves, Town Hall's director of patron and community engagement, was inspired to bring the idea to Colorado when she was scrolling through Instagram and saw a video by Harris. Quote, he said that people must be radically invited into a space in order to know that they belong there, recalled Reeves, end quote. She was struck by what that would mean for a theater company in a community like Littleton, where Black people make up less than 1% of the town's population. Reeves said the theater is excited to present the Colorado premiere of Raisin. The story covers a difficult time in the life of the Youngers, a black family living on the south side of Chicago in the 1950s, as they struggle to prosper in the face of racism and housing discrimination. Being the first theater in the state to host a blackout night feels like a, quote, delightful surprise to Reeves. Quoting, as a PWI, or predominantly white institution, I think a lot of times people get scared to take on those kinds of topics or those kinds of shows, said Reeves, who went on. But I think for us, we took a really important turn in looking at that and saying, quote, not only are these shows and these stories important to be able to tell, but we need to bring those communities in order to be able to tell their stories themselves, end quote. Director Paige Sanders sees the blackout performance as an opportunity to use theater as a vehicle for change and outreach, and a chance to get more people involved in the arts. Quote, it's about finding accessibility. Theater, for many of us, can be more than just entertainment, end quote. However, blackout events in other cities have been met with some controversy. While the goal of blackout is to provide a space for as many black-identifying audience members as possible, no one is turned away. Parentheses, Saturday's show at Town Hall will also include subscribers who already purchased tickets. Despite the explanation, the concept has critics, including British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, whose official spokesperson earlier this year described a West End theater's blackout nights as, quote, concerning and divisive. Reeves acknowledged that Town Hall has also gotten some pushback for the show, which she attributes mainly due to the phrase, free from the white gaze, in the event description. However, she feels the team has successfully communicated the mission behind the event. On its website, Town Hall explains, quote, Town Hall Arts Center believes that communities who may otherwise not see themselves in our space must be radically invited in order to know that they belong and are welcomed here, end quote. Reeves credits Ashley Vara, the company's house manager and patron experience associate, who joined Town Hall Arts Center last year during the run of Once on This Island, for not just changing some of the company's cultures, but also illustrating how the experience can be different for different patrons. Reeves said, quote, She's been invaluable in that, and she's been really strategic in helping us to make sure that we're doing this right and not just thinking that we're doing it right, end quote. Quoting again, we're not excluding anybody, but at the same time, we are inviting our community, end quote, explained leading lady Mary Louise Lee, who plays the family matriarch Mama Lena Younger. Lee finds this special one-night event exciting. Quote, we don't see a lot of black people in audiences here in Colorado and other places as well, as many as we need to have in the audience. And so, just like we say all the time, representation matters, Lee said, and she went on. When people see people that look like them on TV, see people that look like them on the stage, see people that look like them in the boardroom, it makes a difference all the time. It makes a difference, end quote. Director Paige Sanders asks anyone uncomfortable with the blackout event to reflect on those feelings. Paige Sanders says, quote, I would ask them to do a heart check, to do a temperature check on their heart and compassion, and knowing the circumstances of those that don't often get the opportunity to come to the theater. End quote. Town Hall's blackout performance of Raisin is this Saturday, April 6th. The show runs through April 14th. For a little more on this concept, blackout, I go to their website, blackoutnight.com, for just a few excerpted paragraphs. What is a blackout? A blackout is the purposeful creation of an environment in which an all-black identifying audience can experience and discuss an event in the performing arts, film, athletic, and cultural spaces, free from the white gaze, a concept birthed by slave play playwright Jeremy O. Harris. The inaugural blackout night took place on September 18, 2019. For the first time in history, all 804 seats of Broadway's Golden Theater were occupied by black-identifying audience members in communion, celebration, and recognition of Broadway's rich, diverse, and fraught history of black work. Based on the success of the first blackout, Slave Play hosted a second blackout on January 8, 2020, to bookend its Broadway run. Since then, other blackout events have organically taken hold. It is our hope and intention that this site inspires, facilitates, and informs future blackout events, and in the words of Harris, that, quote, this outreach will snowball into more representation of black bodies both on stage and off, end quote. Continuing with Denver publications, this next article comes from 5280, written by Ethan Pan, published, it just says, in March. Denver's best African food. From Ethiopian to Ghanaian to South African, we've got nearly every culinary corner of the continent covered. Before kneeling to pray, Chakib Marakchi handed me a to-go cup of mint tea. He said, quote, it's cold out there. Nighttime would overtake the October twilight before Marakchi could lock the doors to Cafe Paprika, which meant the Isha prayer, the last of five in daily Islamic practice, and one that is typically offered at the beginning of complete darkness, would occur here in his North African restaurant along East Mississippi Avenue in Aurora. I had been the only customer for an hour, but I had waited until after my meal of lamb tagine to ask the native of Fez, the second largest city in Morocco, a few questions. How did he flavor the couscous? Does he steep the tea to order? But before I finished collecting my thoughts, I heard the recitations in his warm, low voice. Marakchi was kneeling face down on a mat in the middle of the dining room, which was silent except for his muffled words. A prayer that, despite being uttered by millions of U.S. residents every day, I had never heard before. The experience was a reminder that thousands of miles away from Fez and every other part of the world's second largest continent, Denverites can only taste a sliver of what Africa has to offer here along the Front Range. Despite the enticing array of eateries that exist across the metro area, there are entire regions of Africa that go under, that's unrepresented in Colorado's dining scene. And even the restaurants we can enjoy, nearly all of which are immigrant-run, must often find compromise between traditional recipes, American palates, and financial resources. That narrative isn't unusual for many restaurants that serve diasporic foods. However, because many African cuisines have not been as widely exported to the United States as, say, Chinese or Indian cuisine, business owners may feel more pressure to faithfully replicate the flavors of home, especially if they rely on an African customer base. But that can be a tricky proposition when the same restaurants also need to woo a non-African clientele that can have unadventurous palates. Furthermore, African immigrants may face tougher financial challenges than other communities, according to 2022 reports from the Migration Policy Institute, Sub-Saharan African and North African, parentheses, analyzed jointly with Middle Eastern. Immigrants in the United States have lower household incomes compared to the country's total foreign-born population, despite attaining higher levels of education. It's perhaps not surprising, then, that the histories of many African restaurants in Denver seem to include more tumult than might be expected, even in an already volatile industry. Relocations, multi-year hiatuses, and closures have been distressingly common, In fact, two long-standing East Colfax Avenue fixtures, Africana Restaurant and Cafe, and Axum Ethiopian Restaurant, shuttered last year. Still, there is a litany of restaurateurs who, through their tenacity, have been able to endure, and their persistence has helped create a culinary timeline of Denver's African food scene that illustrates its unique evolution and widening range of options. Marakchi's restaurant is just one of those stalwarts. A few weeks after my visit, I called him, and he gave me the answers I needed. He seasons his couscous with salt and olive oil, and, yes, he steeps the tea to order. But I found myself wanting to ask the 64-year-old, who has run Cafe Paprika largely on his own since 2020, about more than food. How much longer will he continue to operate the 31-year-old eatery? He says, quote, "People beg me to stay open, but I can't work all my life," end quote. Instead, he wants to pass the restaurant on to new ownership instead of closing it, a move that would allow Denverites to continue experiencing a taste of Africa here at home. The article continues with the next section, Denver's Best African Food Trucks. Number one, Taste of Soweto. Taste of Soweto offers more than culinary thrills. It offers a taste of history. Quote, "During apartheid in South Africa, Soweto was established as a black neighborhood outside of Johannesburg," said Mpho Gift Mapolo, who co-owns the food truck with his wife and former pastry chef, Ocean. The Soweto natives debuted the pop-up business in 2019 and transitioned it onto wheels in 2021. And, although it's not the first South African food business in Denver, it is the first black-owned one. "The distinction is important," Ocean says, quote, "We are all South Africans, but there are dishes that white people grew up eating that we don't eat, and vice versa," end quote. For a taste of how the Mapaulos grew up, try the peri-peri chicken wings tossed in Ocean's signature paprika-laced sauce, or the kota, an Indian heritage dish, often called bunny chow, of beef or chicken curry, stuffed into a hollowed-out quarter loaf of white bread. Having seen other African restaurateurs lose their community's support due to a lack of authenticity, the Mapaulos have prioritized accurately replicating their homeland's flavors. For instance, they haven't debuted a curryless version of kota popular in Soweto because certain ingredients have been difficult to procure. In the meantime, they keep trucking, hoping to start selling bottles of Ocean's peri-peri sauce this year, as well as Mumfo's homemade ginger beer, which is a hit at catering gigs. As for establishing a permanent location, they're waiting to build a larger following. Mpho says, quote, "I know a couple of African immigrants who painstakingly started brick and mortars. I'm not looking forward to that yet," end quote. Next, a must try, Kalahari Wars, that's spelled W-O-R-S. No South African barbecue or braai is complete without sausage. The kind you'll most often find is seasoned with coriander, nutmeg, and cloves, among other spices, and is often called boer wors, which means boar sausage in Afrikaans. Boer, B-O-E-R, refers to descendants of largely Dutch colonists who settled South Africa starting in the 1600s. Despite being the sausage's namesake, however, they didn't entirely invent it. Mpho points to the included Asian spices as evidence. As such, the Mapaulos named their version after the Kalahari Desert to inclusively reference its origins. Whether he's making his links with pork or beef, or only the latter, Mpho keeps their fat levels at 20% to prevent them from over-shrinking when cooked. The sausage is often served with pap, a firm corn porridge, and chakalaka, a vegetable relish. At Taste of Soweto, purchase it in a hot dog-like sandwich topped with tomato, onion, and lettuce, and if you're hosting your own braai, frozen by the kilogram. Number two, Msosi Kenyan Cuisine. Umsosi Kenyan cuisine keeps it humble. The truck has no elaborate wrap job, and its East African offerings are less heavily spiced than many dishes found in local Ethiopian or West African joints. But when you pick up your order, you'll walk away remembering owner Josphat Ombacho's generous smile as he handed over your samosas or mandazi, which is, parentheses, slightly sweet fried dough. Make your midday meal. Msosi often parks on the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus during lunch hours out of tomatoey chicken stew and spiced pilau rice. Number 3, Pikain Grill Express. Not sure about the pronunciation. It is spelled P-I-K-I-N-E. Pikini? Don't know. Founded in 2015, Senegalese chef David Diop's Pikain Grill Express was the first food truck in the United States representing his native country's cuisine. In January, Diop moved its permanent location to a new spot near the Denver-Aurora border, taking the chance to also revamp his menu. While devoted customers can still find favorites like the chicken brochettes and the grilled lamb dibi, he now prepares meatless versions of mafé, peanut stew, and fataya, fried hand pies, which Diop developed in part to cater to the growing number of African and African-American Coloradans he's seen cutting meat from their diets. Number 4, the Ethiopian food truck. Years before launching Konjo Ethiopian Food in Edgewater Public Market, Fetian Gebre Michael and Yosef Asefa were rolling up injera in their first food business together, the Ethiopian food truck. Look out for the vibrant vehicle. It's green, red, and yellow, like the Ethiopian flag, between May and September at events across the Denver metro area. Whether you're going for a Tibbs plate, parentheses chicken or beef simmered in spiced butter and served with a vegetable side, or a two-part veggie combo, the red lentils are a must-have component. And this article continues with perhaps at least 10 other descriptions, and I'm going to save that for the future. Moving now to other news. This comes from the Wall Street Journal. Biden loses support among black men, Wall Street Journal poll finds. New survey of 7 battleground states also shows some black women are weighing other options. This was written by Cameron McWhirter, Joe Barrett, and Joshua Jamison, published April 11th. President Biden faces a dual nature challenge to shore up his support with black Americans, one of the Democratic Party's most loyal constituencies. Perhaps the most urgent, more black men say they plan to back Donald Trump this fall, according to a recent Wall Street Journal poll of 7 swing states. While most black men said they intend to support Biden, some 30% of them in the poll said they were either definitely or probably going to vote for the former Republican president. There isn't comparable Wall Street Journal swing state polling from 2020, but Trump received votes from 12% of black men nationwide that year, as recorded by AP Votecast, a large poll of the electorate. In the Wall Street Journal poll, 11% of black women said they were either definitely or probably going to vote for Trump. In 2020, the AP poll found 6% of black women nationwide backed Trump. Quote, "I think winning back more black men is going to be key for him," end quote. Michael Bossian, a Democratic pollster who conducted the survey, said of Biden. Bossian completed the poll along with the company of Tony Fabrizio, a Republican. Fabrizio, who worked for a pro-Trump super political action committee when the survey was conducted, has since joined the Trump campaign. On the other hand, while black women are less likely than black men to support Trump, some are exploring other options, including third parties and potentially staying home. In a sign that Biden hasn't yet won commitments from many of these voters, some 42% of black women in the survey fell into a group that the Journal pollsters say are up for grabs in the election or still persuadable in their vote choice. These voters say they have not yet decided on a candidate, might vote for an independent or third-party option, or are likely, but not certain, to back one of the major party candidates. While Latino women and Black men in the survey also signaled in large numbers that they remain persuadable in their vote choice, the share of Black women is noteworthy given that they are among the most loyal Democratic groups in the electorate. Biden's standing has taken a hit with some Black voters as they, like many others, express discontent with his performance on broad issues such as the economy and immigration. While the Black gender split on Biden mirrors one that exists with the electorate overall, losing Black support in particular would be a blow to Biden's re-election prospects, given how vital Black Americans are to the Democratic coalition. Quote, "In this particular election, the persuasion isn't just to vote or not to vote," end quote, said Adrian Shropshire, head of Black PAC, a Democratic super PAC. She went on, quote, "The persuasion is actually to get people to come to Biden and away from third parties and away from Trump," end quote. Bossian said it is an unheard of to see Black voters poll soft on Democrats before coming around to the party's candidates closer to Election Day. That said, quote, "Biden is further off than where we have seen Democrats in the past," said Bossian. An aide for the Biden campaign said its $25 million advertising campaign, announced in August to reach key voters in battleground states, included the largest and earliest investment in Black media for a re-election campaign in history. A representative for the Trump campaign said, quote, "Our coalition message to Black and Hispanic communities this election is simple. If you want strong borders, safe neighborhoods, rising wages, quality jobs, school choice, and the return of the strongest economy in over 60 years, then vote for Donald J. Trump, end quote. Percy Jones, a Black restaurant manager who lives in Atlanta's West End, said Biden just hasn't been an impressive president. He is remembering Trump's time in office more fondly, most notably on immigration. Jones said, quote, "He didn't allow people who don't live here to come in. They're taking all of our jobs," end quote. Jones didn't vote in 2020, but said he probably would this year and would likely vote for Trump. As President Biden, quote, he says Jones, "wasn't really helping the community," end quote. "The stimulus checks helped people during the COVID-19 lockdowns, but now those are gone," he said. He went on, quote, "He has a lot of people fooled," speaking of Biden. In Milwaukee, Paul Wigham, 51 years old, a chef who owns Mi Casa Su Cafe, said he understands the appeal of Trump. Wigham hasn't had a chance to really focus on the election. Most of his time is spent trying to keep his restaurant open when it is difficult to find staff, he said. He said he probably will end up supporting Biden, but he sees why some Black men like Trump. He said, quote, "He doesn't speak like the average politician with a bunch of jargon. His rhetoric is scathing at times. A lot of people say it's hurtful, demeaning to other ethnicities and races and stuff like that, but I think he speaks plain English," end quote. Still, most Black men, 57%, say they back Biden over Trump. Tony Clay, 40, a barber in Atlanta's predominantly Black West End neighborhood, said he feels that Trump is trying to undermine democracy. He said he felt Trump was too cozy with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Clay said, quote, "People talk about the economy, but I feel our freedom is at stake," end quote. Brittany Brown, 37, who works at Noir Hair District, a salon in Milwaukee's Bronzeville neighborhood, which has many Black-owned businesses, said she voted for Biden in 2020 but regrets it. She said, quote, "I haven't seen any of his policies or the things that he said he was going to do for the American people coming to fruition," end quote. She would like to see more spending on inner cities and programs that help the Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities, but feels they have all been let down by Democrats. Though the inflation rate has come down, she said she was still struggling to get by on Wisconsin's minimum wage, which is also the national minimum. She said, quote, "A gallon of milk is $5 in some places, yet I make $7.25. Make it make sense," end quote. But that hasn't made her a fan of Trump. She said, quote, He would be horrible for us, in my opinion, of the former president. Her plan on election day is to write in Jasmine Sherman, who is running for president with a socialist-led party. She said, quote, "People are tired of being lied to and hearing empty promises." Tyra Griffin, 39, who lives in Atlanta and works for a medical office, voted for Biden in 2020. She falls in the category of black women who are down on Biden but say they probably will vote for him again. And the next article is an opinion guest essay from the New York Times posted April 11th. "It's Time to End the Quiet Cruelty of Property Taxes," written by Andrew W. Carey. Pardon me, that's Carl, K-A-H-R-L. Dr. Carl is a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Virginia and the author of The Black Tax, 150 Years of Theft, Exploitation, and Dispossession in America. I'm not sure, but this may be edited for length by me. Property taxes, the lifeblood of local governments and school districts, are among the most powerful and stealthy engines of racism and wealth inequality our nation has ever produced. And while the Biden administration has offered many solutions for making the tax code fairer, it has yet to effectively tackle a problem that has resulted not only in the extraordinary overtaxation of black and Latino homeowners, but also in the worsening of disparities between wealthy and poorer communities. Fixing these problems requires nothing short of fundamental reexamination of how taxes are distributed. In theory, the property tax would seem to be an eminently fair one. The higher the value of your property, the more you pay. The problem with this system is that the tax is administered by local officials who enjoy a remarkable degree of autonomy, and the tax rates are typically based on the collective wealth of a given community. This results in wealthy communities enjoying lower effective tax rates while generating more tax revenues. At the same time, poorer ones are forced to tax property at higher effective rates while generating less in return. As such, property assessments have been manipulated throughout our nation's history to ensure that valuable property is taxed the least relative to its worth, and that the wealthiest places will always have more resources than poorer ones. Black people have paid the heaviest costs. Since they began acquiring property after emancipation, African Americans have been overtaxed by local governments. By the early 1900s, an acre of black-owned land was valued, for tax purposes, higher than an acre of white-owned land in most of Virginia's counties, according to my calculations, despite being worth about half as much. And for all of the taxes black people paid, they got little to nothing in return. Where black neighborhoods began, paved streets, sidewalks, and water and sewer lines often ended. Black taxpayers helped to pay for the better-resourced schools white children attended, even as white supremacists treated, quote, colored schools as another of the white man's burdens. The truth was that throughout the Jim Crow era, black taxpayers subsidized white education. Freedom from these kleptocratic regimes drove millions of African Americans to move to northern and midwestern states in the Great Migration between 1915 to 1970. But they were unable to escape racist assessments, which encompassed both the undervaluation of their property for sales purposes and the overvaluation of their property for taxation purposes. During those years, the nation's real estate industry made white-owned property in white neighborhoods worth more because it was white. Since local tax revenue was tied to local real estate markets, newly formed suburbs had a fiscal incentive to exclude black people, and cities had even more reason to keep black people confined to urban ghettos. As the post-war metropolis became a patchwork of local governments, each with its own tax base, the fiscal rationale for segregation intensified. Cities were fiscally incentivized to cater to the interests of white homeowners and provide better services for white neighborhoods, especially as middle-class white people began streaming into the suburbs, taking their tax dollars with them. One way to cater to wealthy and white homeowners' interests is to intentionally conduct property assessments less often. The City of Boston did not conduct a citywide property reassessment between 1946 and 1977. Over that time, the values of properties in black neighborhoods increased slowly when compared with the values in white neighborhoods, or even fell, which led to property owners paying relatively more in taxes than their homes were worth. At the same time, owners of properties in white neighborhoods got an increasingly good tax deal as their neighborhoods increased in value. And I'm going to stop the article there. It brings us to the end of our time, but rather than edit it for length as I went, I decided to finish this next week. I may pick it up from the beginning, even. But that's the end of our time for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. This was the Black Experience Hour.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.